Asians are one of the most bullied demographics in America. So I knew I wasn't alone in this. But if we could change that feeling, if we could shed those feelings of shame and turn them into empowerment, how awesome would that be? I wish there was a band like that when I was a kid. All throughout my life, I thought, I wish I could see someone like me. And we don't even have to say we're here to like take down stereotypes or anything like that. Just by us merely existing, that was an activist statement in of itself.
You're listening to Rock the Boat, a purpose-driven podcast highlighting Asians who challenge the status quo. Our mission is to elevate the voices of Asians, showcase the diverse careers of Asians around the world, and discuss important topics affecting our community, such as mental health and civic engagement. I'm your host, Lucia Liu. Hi, listeners. Welcome to episode 5 of season 5 of Rock the Boat. This season, we are partnering with the Model Majority podcast to bring you Asian Americans who are challenging the status quo in politics, public health, advocacy, and civic engagement. A few months back, a guy named Simon Tam reached out to me to share his story. Simon is the founder of the all-Asian American band called The Slants. He shared with me the incredible story of his band. It wasn't a story where his band's songs hit the Billboard 100 or a story of him making it big as a rock musician, but it was a story of a Supreme Court case that he was embroiled in for the last 10 years. Prior to Simon reaching out to me, I hadn't heard about his story, but Simon's story had been featured on NPR, NBC News, The Washington Post, LA Times, basically all the major news outlets. Our friends at the Model Majority podcast also spoke with Simon about his landmark Supreme Court case. After reading Simon's pitch, I was super intrigued. So what was this case actually about? Well, it was a trademark case for the name of his band, The Slants. Simon named his band The Slants with the intention of reclaiming the derogatory racial slur historically used to oppress Asian Americans. And it wasn't an easy name to reclaim. It took Simon 10 years and a vote from the United States Supreme Court to finally trademark his band name. Here's a clip from KGW News about the details of his Supreme Court case.
A Supreme Court ruling involving a local band that will likely anger some while perhaps empowering others. Portland's indie rock band, The Slants, will be allowed to trademark their name.
Back in 2011, they were denied because their name was considered derogatory to Asians. KGW's Chris Willis joins us. And Chris, this ruling has really huge implications.
And this may open the door to other high-profile cases, like, for example, the Washington Redskins, whose trademark was canceled due to complaints from Native Americans. Today's ruling said, quote, "The federal government cannot refuse to register most trademarks, even if some people consider them offensive."
Last year, in 2019, The Slants retired from live touring and are now more focused on their Asian American community and racial justice work. So I talked to Simon about how his identity growing up influenced him to start an Asian American rock band and his work today on empowering other Asian American artists.
Remember counting the days, remember grasping for moments. Freedom was a digital way.
Well, Simon, I am so glad we got back together, and I'm so glad to have you on Rock the Boat. Do you mind quickly introducing yourself?
Sure. My name is Simon Tam. I'm the founder and bassist for The Slants, and right now the board chair for The Slants Foundation.
Amazing. Question for you. Were you ever a Guitar Hero fan?
Yeah, but I'd say probably about the medium level of Guitar Hero. I wouldn't want to go too far beyond that, because I just absolutely just suck.
Why a band around Asian American identity?
I oftentimes share that there's this very particular moment when watching a movie, Kill Bill from Quentin Tarantino, And there's a scene where Oren Ishii walks into this restaurant with her gang of crazy 88s, like the Asian mafia that she led,
But yeah, it's Lucy Liu, right? It's
played it by is, Lucy Liu. Yeah. And it has the iconic song, like Battle Without Honor Humanity, which has appeared in a lot of other films now, like including the Transformers. But I was just like, oh my, like this is so cool because they made those characters look really cool and tough and sexy. And I'd never seen that before. Like my whole life growing up, I'd never seen Asian or Asian American actors depicted that way in American film. And when I started thinking about my craft, like music, the thing that I love and risked everything for in terms of my life and my career for, I thought, wow, if it's like this bad in Hollywood, music is a lot worse. I mean, up until that point, there had never been a single Asian American that had been profiled in Rolling Stone or Spin Magazine or Paste or all the publications that I'd followed. I couldn't think of anybody on MTV. And I was like, there's like, you know, almost 20 million Asian Americans in this country. How come this isn't a thing? And so that's when I decided like something needed to change. Like all I could think of was like, oh, there's that one dude in Smashing Pumpkins, you know, like Jimmy Hall. That was it kind of back then. Yeah. And we didn't have YouTube. There wasn't a way to discover Asian American art. If you wanted to find music out, there was no Spotify or Pandora. You turned to the music magazines. You flipped on the television. And if they weren't there, unless they were touring in your area and you just happened to see them on live on stage, like they were invisible to you. So I didn't think of anybody. And I was like, I don't know. I'm just kind of tired of being like the token Asian person all the time. What if there was a band that actually celebrated Asian American identity and really put that front and center as a part of their work? That would be just so cool. And so that's, of course, when the idea for The Slants was born.
Well, Simon, I just think that you have such an incredible story. You were born in the States and you grew up in San Diego. Tell me a bit about you as a kid. Like, what was little Simon like?
Oh, my goodness. Well, as a kid, I think I had a lot of things that I thought was normal and my parents assumed it was normal. But I think looking back, it wasn't that normal.
Were you the only child?
No, I was the middle kid.
Oh, okay.
When I kind of reflect back on like what I like to do, I mean, in addition to pretending to play music, because I didn't actually pick up the bass guitar until I was 10, like, but before that, I would pretend to play music. I would actually reorganize my room for fun. Like I was really into my bookshelf and like rearranging the books by color, by subject, by release date. Like, and this is like when I was in first or second grade.
I could really use your help decorating our new apartment.
Well, I'm not great at decorating, but I love organizing things. I love like seeing things that are in disorder and finding a way to put it together in a way that it makes sense. At least it made sense to me. Like, it would just be anything in the house. I would go in and rearrange all the canned food in my parents' pantry like, in a way that I thought like, oh, this would be very useful to somebody. So that was just something I did for fun as a kid. But I think probably just because I was really uncomfortable with this idea of like things being kind of out of place, like it didn't really make sense. And then I had a difficult time finding a use for it. And that might have been from the fact that like when I was in school, I felt like I was the one that was out of place. If you were to talk to some, like, you know, do a deep dive into like what made up my mental state, I imagine that would probably be one of those reasons, because for the longest time, I was like the only Asian kid in school, or like one of like four or five of them. My dad actually immigrated as a teenager, and my mom kind of pretty close to it. So they'd been here for decades. They already had their lives established here. Families were here. And so, you know, they thought, hey, we're going to give him a head start. He's going to learn this. My parents were actually so worried about me fitting in at school that they put me into all these learning programs before I even entered into preschool. So I was doing studies and workbooks and reading and writing at probably like a third grade level before I entered in preschool. And same thing with math. So when I actually went into the public school system, like we walked up to the elementary school that was behind our house, my parents brought me there. I took their placement test, and they actually recommended that my parents put me in ESL. And they basically told my parents, we don't want him ever speaking any of your Oriental languages at home. And my parents were taken aback by this. And they're like, what are you talking about? They're like, you know, he's American. He speaks English. And they're like, he might be able to sound like one, but he'll never look like one. And this is just something that I didn't even learn until I was in my 30s. Like, my parents never told me why I was in ESL classes. And so even in my ESL classes, I felt out of place. I was like, why am I here? I know how to spell banana. I know that you shouldn't like smell car exhaust or whatever the lessons were. I was like, this is very strange. How come I can't have nap time and recess like everybody else?
How did that sort of affect you in your identity growing up? Did you feel a certain way about being Asian?
The first time I kind of realized that I was a little bit out of place was when kids would kind of make fun of me for my eyes, like, why do you look like that? Or because of my hair. And that's when I kind of started realizing, okay, something's not quite right here. I'm the one that's standing out now. Mm-hmm. And over the years, as I kind of progressed through elementary school, I started getting bullied more and more, mostly from the junior high kids, because our elementary school is connected with a junior high. And then as I entered in junior high school, it came from my peers. So in addition to being made fun of, I was physically attacked multiple times. I was jumped. And to this day, I still have a scar on the top of my head from when kids are using rocks and throwing them at me and beating my head with them.
Was there a time when you ended up in a place where there were more Asians and you felt like, oh, that you saw other people like you?
When I entered high school, there was enough to have like an API club at school.
Yeah.
But I didn't join that club. For some reason, I was like, I don't want to be lumped in with all of them, probably because of my life experiences of just getting harassed and beat up. By the time I became a teenager, all I could associate with my identity was shame and embarrassment. And you know, I walked up to my dad and when I was a teenager and I was like, Dad, I'm ashamed of being Chinese. And it broke his heart. My parents, they worked so hard for me and my siblings. But I was just like, I'm tired of getting killed out there. I'm tired of being made fun of. Like, it's ridiculous that in English class, even though I know the answer, they never call on me. But they always call me on math, even though I don't know the answer. Like, this is like, what's up with that? Like, how come I have to keep and at that time, I thought they didn't get it. But of course they got it. Like, they immigrated here. They knew what it was like. They knew what it was like to be denied financing and housing.
How much of starting the Slants was also part of reclaiming your own identity as an Asian American?
I think that probably a lot more of it than I would have admitted back then. I mean, I said and did a lot of terrible things when I was in high school because I was scared, because I was ashamed, because I was hurt. And I think maybe this was a way of finding my way back, a way to be connected with my family and my community. So I think a lot of it was a kind of a journey. And I think with the band, if you look at the kind of our career trajectory and how we kind of dabbled with ideas of Asian American identity in the beginning and really evolved that to a point where we were working hand in hand with statewide policy groups and advocacy organizations across this country, that was also my evolution as well as someone mm-hmm. who's trying to figure out where my identity played in my advocacy work, in my activism.
Can we talk a bit about why you had wanted to do activism or work in nonprofits in the first place?
When I was 13, I met a local youth pastor named Alan Diaz, and he was looking for volunteers for people who wanted to go into parts of Mexico to build community centers, houses, orphanages, things like that. And so I thought, hey, that would be cool. Some of my friends are involved. And I just started volunteering. And then I was like, this is incredible. Like, I just found it so rewarding. I said, anytime you're sending a team in, you need a volunteer, please let me know. And so I, you know, throughout high school, this is what I spent all of my summer breaks, winter breaks, and spring break doing. And sometimes on the weekends, I would volunteer. We would, you know, set up feeding programs throughout San Diego and that sort of thing. And I just had a really big thirst for it. And I knew that, like, I wanted to give my life to helping other people. So that was just something that I think had really influenced a lot of how I thought about things. And I thought, well, if I'm going to go to school, like, I don't necessarily want to just major in something that's going to be very lucrative or something like that. I wanted to understand, like, why people thought. And as I was kind of taking my general education studies, I actually took a philosophy course at a community college. And it was just like an intro to philosophy class. But up until that point, I'd never found anything as enjoyable as that. Mm-hmm. And so that was like, I just spent all day like reading. I just loved it.
Yeah. Did your parents give you pushback for studying what you studied, considering they wanted you to be a doctor or a programmer, a computer programmer?
I think my guess is they probably would have rather me study something else more like in the sciences. But they were just happy that I was there. I mean, I got in and I was on a full ride. So they were really, really excited about that. And I was the first in my family to go to college. So they were just like really thrilled to see that I was doing that. And they probably thought like, oh, well, maybe you'll go to grad school and do something else with it. And, you know, the irony is I never even finished the UCR program.
Yeah, you dropped out to join a punk rock band.
Yeah, a couple months before graduating. So not the best idea in the world for anyone going through education. But, you know, in hindsight, it turned out to be one of the best decisions I've ever made.
Oh, what was kind of going through your mind when you decided to take the plunge and quit school to play full-time in a band?
I think, one, I was in a long-term relationship. Romantic relationship that had just ended. Mm. And, you know, that was 7 years. So I just didn't know who I was. So I think I just needed a change. Second of all, music was my dream. I was doing nonprofit work and I enjoyed it, but I didn't feel like I was living my life purpose, like that, the calling. And I thought, I could always come back to this. I can always go back to school. I can always try this route again. But how many times am I going to have the opportunity to just pick up, move across the country and join this band? And things seemed to be lining up for it. But I think the bigger surprise was when I talked to my parents about dropping out, they actually were supportive. Like, that was one of the most difficult conversations I thought I would ever have, because like, that was their dream. They had been working for the whole lives to see one of their kids graduate college. But they saw how unhappy I was in my current state. And so when I was like, I'm thinking about doing this, they just said, hey, promise you'll come back and finish school one day. And I was like, yeah, I promise. I love learning. I'll get that degree, but I have to do this. And so they gave me their blessing.
With your background in advocacy work, with your background in nonprofit, when was it that you felt like you could sort of marry your music with the work that you do for the Asian American community?
I think early on, we kind of played with it, but we didn't quite understand it. And I think because originally when I started the band, I thought this is not going to be some kind of political band. It's not like a social political project. We're a band first and foremost. But at the same time, from the perspective of being a human being, it's like, how can you sit on the sidelines when you see what's unfolding in the world before you, knowing you can make a difference, but choosing not to? That became the thing I realized I didn't want to stand back anymore. So what really changed it was the fact that when we launched, and we launched on myspace.com, so that gives you an idea of how old I am and how old the band is. But like, yeah, so, you know, we kicked it off. We were friends with Far East Movement, you know, like Tila Tequila was there. That was like the Asian American MySpace, right? Like, so yeah. We were there. And I started getting,
and that's awesome, by the way.
I started getting messages and letters from kids like all across this country saying, thank you. Like I love rock music, but I've never been able to see myself in it. Or thank you for making me proud of my heritage and who I am. And when you get stuff like that, kids would send us cards and treats for Chinese New Year, a little red envelope saying, thank you. And I'm like, okay, whether we like it or not, like I can't disappoint them. We're going to be judged for it, like who we are for our racial identity anyway. So we might as well just jump in with both feet in and see what we can do, how we can help. And so that's when I started reaching out to community organizations. You know, at first, mostly around the Portland, Oregon area, but then more nationally as we traveled. And we've been doing anti-racism workshops and workshops around culture and Asian American identity since like 2008. So a year after our band launched in, we were already doing like these workshops. And sometimes if we got booked at an anime convention or video game convention, I said, okay, that's fine. But one of the requirements of booking our band is you have to give us at least a panel to talk about this, to talk about the fact that you all are celebrating Asian culture without any Asian people planning it. Like there's something that's meaningful about that. And like, mm-hmm. while you're claiming you love anime, you love K-pop, that's great. But how can you take that love and turn it into appreciation for a history and a culture? And what does it mean for people who look like me showing up at these things, who
totally
don't feel the same love from you when we're outside these walls?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I see so many parallels between that and also Asia's love for R&B and hip hop.
Yeah.
They have all this like love for streetwear and R&B and rap and hip hop, yet there's very little attribution to the Black community for that type of music. So I think it's real important, the work that you're doing and educating and getting people to show appreciation for where a lot of this like culture is coming from.
Yeah. And it's just that, like for me, it was like always interesting that you had all these like people who I think were very well-intentioned in their love of like the pop culture, but I wanted them to see what was underneath it all. The first time we played an anime convention, which was only our fourth show that we ever played as a band, I had never played a show like that in my whole career as a musician, like just jam-packed. So there's that on the one hand. On the other hand, as we were sitting at our merchandise table, we're doing autographs, I would just like hear all these microaggressions all the time. We're in an anime convention, so the kids come up and they're just like, hey, which one of your songs are in Japanese? I'm like, well, our singer is Vietnamese, so none of them. But good news, they're in English, so you can understand all the lyrics. They'd be like really disappointed. And they'd be like, hey, which one of you are Japanese? And I'm like, well, we were actually Chinese, Japanese, Korean. There's multiple ethnic identities in this band. It's like a buffet. It's like we got a little bit of everything. But it would always disappoint them.
Yeah.
Or they would just come up and just start speaking Japanese to me. Like, what does watashi wa mean? I'm like, hey, like, you know, and that's when I realized I want to pair this up with some kind of educational moment so people understand this. It's great that you're appreciating this facet of culture, but let's talk about how it's tied in together and what you can do with it. Don't just take and take and take. Find a way to give back to this culture that you love so much.
How are you using your band's platform in this day and age when it's apparent that anti-Asian sentiment has been really brought to the forefront with COVID?
Well, last fall, we actually played our last show as a full band. We kind of made the decision to retire from touring as like a full band. And that was because we really want to concentrate our efforts and our philanthropy work. We launched this nonprofit called the Science Foundation. And we just really want to be very much focused on that. The original purpose of it was to provide resources and mentoring to Asian American artists, especially those who want to incorporate like activism and activist values into their work. And so we'd find ways to make their careers more sustainable and provide all these things to help make that happen. On the onset of COVID, we saw all this like rampant rise in anti-Asian discrimination, we realized that we need to pivot a little bit and find ways to not only like continue funding the work of artists, but finding ways to neuter some of the hate that we saw out there by focusing on supporting artists who are doing works to counter that hate. So we started offering grants that we called our Countering Hate Grant Program, where we wanted to fund works that drove a more complex conversation around identity, ones that asked questions rather than made angry statements, ones that got people to engage on a deeper level. And so that's been really rewarding, like working with a number of artists. I think this year we funded over a dozen projects, and we helped fiscally sponsor and launch a different mentorship program specifically for women and non-binary folks of the Asian diaspora. And so seeing it from this perspective of where I am now, it's definitely different, but I think it's really exciting because I can use all of the goodwill, all the audiences and things that we've developed over the years for a band to a much higher purpose. And a few folks got angry at us and decided they didn't want anything to do with us because they wanted to rock and roll. But I think a lot more people opened up to us in a different kind of way. It's really amazing to step down from touring life in that particular way, because now I have so much more capacity just to think about these projects and to think about how can we respond to the problems that we're seeing in the world and how can we use art as a force to help solve some of those problems. One of the things that we decided that we wanted to do that I think was very much in line with the nonprofit was like, hey, bands don't have to just be the band members that are in them. So we can actually work with other people. And that's one of the things that we're working on now for our next album. We're actually collaborating with Asian American artists across the country, like all kinds of musicians and singers, so that we could feature them on our album and lift up their work and say, hey, we're not touring anymore, but you should check out this in person because they're killing it.
Do you still participate in any sort of the legal aspects of winning that monumental Supreme Court case around being able to name your band The Slants?
These days, I spend a lot of time teaching CLE, which is continued legal education. It's something required for anyone practicing in law. Uh-huh. So I teach about my case, and I teach about how to build more equitable laws in our society and how judges and lawyers can develop more inclusive practices in their work. So that's a lot of what I do on the side. But at the same time, I still found ways to get involved with the law. So even after we won our case at the Supreme Court, in the following years, I actually have filed multiple briefs at the Supreme Court. One was on a case that was pretty similar as my case for striking down the rest of the law that we fought against that was written in the Jim Crow era. It was never designed to protect communities that we tend to think are a little more vulnerable. It was designed to protect the status quo. So I helped take down the rest of the law. And then also joined a brief with rappers like Killer Mike, Chance the Rapper, Meek Mill. We all stood together to file a brief in support of the government not being able to use rap lyrics as evidence against musicians. So because what they were doing is they were charging people who would have lyrics that could be, you know,
incriminating.
Yeah, like it could be perceived as violent. So people were using them to arrest teenagers and charge them with terrorism because they're like, oh, they're threatening police officers because they're covering like an NWA song or something like that. It's like, that's ridiculous, obviously. You would you didn't see people arresting country artists like Johnny Cash for singing about murder, but here you are doing it to Black youth. That's not cool. So we've been writing a lot of briefs, like trying to protect their freedom of expression as artists themselves.
As a community organizer and a band leader and an advocate, how can we as like a community come together?
This is something I think about all the time. I think that one of the things that people have to do is be more intentional with this idea of not only of like connecting with one another, but with actually looking for opportunities to create change. I hear people all the time who tell me the reasons why they don't get involved, like they're too busy, or they don't feel like they have the right skill set, or they just don't know how to get started and that sort of thing. And I'm like, that's great, but injustice doesn't care about your excuses. Like find a way to dive in wherever you can, wherever you are, and however you can. If there's something that you really care about, if you're really passionate about education, there are a number of organizations that focus on education. If you care about the arts, like, hey, I got a nonprofit. There's a lot of other nonprofits that really care about the arts. They're probably a philanthropic organization for just about anything that you're passionate about. And if there isn't one, that's an opportunity to start one. So I always tell people, find a way to get involved. And if you don't have the time or capacity to volunteer, then do something simple, like donate $5 a month, because all that adds up. We have to be more than like consumers. I can't just consume information on social media and think like, okay, I did my part. I read about what's happening in the news.
Just like your listeners, right? The concert that you played at the convention center, right? Don't just appreciate the culture, like give back to it.
Exactly. Step in. And I hear a lot of people talk about the importance of Asian American representation and the arts. But it's like, how many of them are actually buying the records of these musicians? And I'm not talking about streaming, because like streaming it's not a sustainable way of supporting the artists that you love. I mean, I have a whole wall of checks for less than a dollar. And when you split that up 4 to 6 ways in a band, it doesn't go very far. Like, that's from streaming. So it's buy people's records or their merchandise or donate to them. There are ways that I think we can hold ourselves accountable as folks who appreciate the arts or like even the activism of other folks. We certainly benefit from people who are putting their lives at risk, protesting, filing briefs, testifying. The least that we can do is support them in some kind of way by volunteering or donating or something else.
Yeah, 100%. Simon, I want to ask you our signature question before we wrap up. How do you, not that you haven't done it enough already, but how do you intend to rock the boat, Simon?
I think I would love to continue looking for those unconventional perspectives and overlooked paths, especially paths towards justice. And right now, that is, I believe, through the arts. I think the arts are a powerful way to hold up as a social mirror, as well as a window into the future for our society. So I'm going to do my very best to continue to support the work of artists who are up and coming, who are bending that moral arc of the universe towards justice. And that, for me, is the most rewarding way of rocking the boat.
Amazing. Thank you so much for sharing your story and for continuing to fight for justice.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Simon Tam, founder of the all Asian American rock band The Slants and now The Slants Foundation. Music, television, film, and all these forms of art are what really have been helping us get through this crazy year that's been 2020. So talking to Simon has been such a great reminder of how important it is to support the arts, especially within our own community. To echo Simon's sentiment, we can keep talking about the importance of representation in media, but what's more important is that we put our money where our mouth is and show the actions that we need to take in order to support all of this talk. It's also really inspiring to hear that Simon continues to be involved with the law after winning his Supreme Court case. He's teaching CLE classes and also still filing cases for the Supreme Court. Even though Simon felt out of place as a kid, he was able to reclaim his cultural identity and sense of control through community organizing and also reaching out to the community and improving the world around him. You can hear more of Simon's Supreme Court case, as well as Simon's journey through that case on NPR. I've included a link in the show notes. Also, be sure to check out Simon and his team at The Slants Foundation. They are at www.theslants.org. Please support the podcast by subscribing to it on iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a 5-star rating if you're listening on iTunes, and definitely tell your friends about it. You can follow us on Instagram at RockTheBoatNYC and subscribe to our mailing list for inside news. Thanks to my associate producer, Rachel Chu, for editing and mixing this episode. Thanks for tuning in, and until next time.